This download is made possible by all the generous folks who support public radio. If that includes you, thank you. If not, become a contributing member to your local station. And now, here's the show. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And 13 years after 9/11, some of you out there have had it with war.
This is Alexander Monroe from Jefferson Township, New Jersey. I don't think that the U.S. should be heavily involved in the war against ISIS. We've done enough in Afghanistan and Iraq. It's time that NATO and the U.N. in general takes a larger role against the war against terror. I think we should be limited to airstrikes only.
But last night, almost as though 13 years hadn't passed since the attacks of 9/11, President Obama spoke about how the U.S. needs to return once again to a wartime footing to deal with the threat of terror.
At this moment, the greatest threats come from the Middle East and North Africa, where radical groups exploit grievances for their own gain. And one of those groups is ISIL, which calls itself the Islamic State.
In an address to the nation from the state floor of the White House, President Obama outlined his strategy for confronting that Islamic State. We've been asking you how ready you are to go back to warfare in the Middle East.
This is Staff Sergeant John Bungren with the North Carolina Army National Guard. Those individuals, they've been at war for well over a millennia. I don't think our further interference is really going to change much. You know, I think the outline where, you know, we assist as we can with airstrikes is good to support them, because if anything is going to resolve itself over there, it's going to be internally. They need to step up and come together.
Sergeant Bongruner reached out to us at 877-8-MY-TAKE, and we encourage you to join this conversation. In his speech last night, the president emphasized that the U.S. will rely on a broad coalition of partners, as well as what he called a reformed Iraqi government, and using military lessons from anti-terror efforts in Yemen and Somalia, which we will talk about in detail in just a moment. But the president also said this is a U.S. fight as well.
I've made it clear that we will hunt down terrorists who threaten our country wherever they are. That means I will not hesitate to take action against ISIL in Syria as well as Iraq. This is a core principle of my presidency. If you threaten America, you will find no safe haven.
Question: how is this approach to the Islamic State in the Levant, ISIL, as the president calls them, how is it different from the war on terror, which we were told began after 9/11, 13 years ago? Joining me now from the Capitol is Linda Robinson, senior international policy analyst at RAND and author of 100 Victories, Special Ops and the Future of American Warfare. Welcome.
Thank you, John. Happy to be with you.
Give me your impression of what we heard from the president. Is this a pulling some old tools off the shelf in Yemen and Somalia and creating an initiative to confront ISIS? Or is this a fundamentally new military doctrine as you see it?
Well, I think there's elements of Yemen and Somalia, but there's, I think, a much heavier reliance on a broader array of partners. But the magnitude of the threat is, it's just a different order of magnitude with what is exists now and has been growing in Iraq and Syria, the Islamic State organization. It's holding New England-sized territory, has, you know, 10,000, above 10,000 members. So it's a much larger and more virulent and well-equipped and well-funded force than Yemen ever was or Somalia ever was. Now, they have kept the pressure on in Yemen and Somalia, integrated those threats, but when the president said, you know, he intends to ultimately destroy this group, the Islamic State, that is taking on a very large threat with a pretty significant commitment.
Do you have to invade a territory the size of Maryland to roll that back? Or, you know, these folks are out in the open there in Iraq and Syria. They're not hiding in the desert like Al-Qaeda was doing in Yemen and, you know, Osama bin Laden was doing in Pakistan. I'm just wondering if the Yemen example is even relevant at all here.
Yes, that's why I would prefer to talk about the facts and the situation on the ground. In terms of the differences, I would like to point out There's a big swath of desert terrain, as you say, up there in this, what I call the New England-sized territory that the Islamic State is now holding. But they also hold cities, Raqqa in Syria, and very importantly, Mosul and Fallujah. And of course, they're holding things like oil refineries. They've threatened a couple of dams. So they're in possession of major assets of that country. What it will take to get in there and roll them back, that is, to me, I have no quarrel with the comprehensive approach that the president laid out. The devil, as always, is in the details, the doability of this. Airstrikes certainly can, and I think already have, to some degree, blunted the momentum. But if the objective is actually to destroy this group, it comes down to how capable are these various partners that he intends to rely upon, because we saw the Iraqi security forces literally crumbling over these past months as the Islamic State got on a roll and began taking over all this territory. I have focused a fair amount on the Iraqi Special Operations Forces through the last decade or so, and our U.S. Special Operations Forces really created, stood up that group, trained them, built them a big training base called Area 4. They had closely mentored and partnered with that group until we left at the end of 2011. So I would say they're probably the most capable partner in terms of actual Iraqi government forces. But you also have Shia militias, very problematic, but also very numerous. They've been very active. You have the Sunnis. They would not have gone out and fought without support from the U.S., and that's one of the misreadings of history, that these Sunni tribes and Sunnis flipped themselves and decided to do this all on their own. So that's the question now, because they don't necessarily trust this new government in Iraq. Finally, there's the Peshmerga, the Kurdish militia. They're probably the most capable and unproblematic partner in this terrain of proxies we're looking at supporting, but they did take over the city of Kirkuk, which was not something the U.S. Government supports. They have their own agenda, but from a military perspective, they're probably the strongest read right now for the U.S. to lean on until they see whatever other of these groups are actually capable and willing.
Would you say there's an uneasy buy-in by the Pentagon here in the sense that it sounds like special operations are going to be taking the lead here, or some slice of the Air Force is going to be taking the lead? I don't get a sense that this is necessarily something that the Pentagon wants to do, but maybe it is a big step on the part of this evolution of special operations that you've written so much about.
Yes, well, I think this is the so-called new way of war that I was writing about. Special operations forces, when you're addressing these kinds of non-state threats or irregular threats, they have a much bigger role. But I'd like to say the special operations forces are quick to say they always need the help of conventional forces, and that can range from support, logistics support, of course the Air Force support, it can be intelligence support, and in the case of training and equipping these various elements, the Iraqi ones I just outlined, but also the Syrian moderate opposition. And so the magnitude of this effort will inevitably include conventional forces. But I think you are right, a lead role, and already in the assessments and the people out there on the ground in Iraq, it has been a soft, heavy force, and they will play a major role.
But, you know, apparently the president authorized raids inside of this territory to free Sotloff and Foley, the hostages, and they were unsuccessful. So I'm just wondering what the track record is at this point.
Yes, and I'm glad you raised that, because it absolutely makes my point that people shouldn't look, just like airstrikes aren't a panacea or a silver bullet, special operations aren't a silver bullet either. And especially when you've got a problem of this magnitude, it's going to take this multi-front approach. And I think that you raise the question of the Pentagon's willingness. I mean, you know, people in uniform, and their job is to execute the policies and goals that the president lays out. And there has been, I've been hearing, No, for a year, many individuals in uniform have been concerned about this growing threat and understand the threat it poses to U.S. interests, not just U.S. citizens, but how our interests are bound up in the region, the creation of a large sanctuary that is now quite large and has abilities. By holding that territory and having all of that armament and finances, they really are the strongest terrorist group we have ever seen. So there is a wide recognition of this problem. The question is, how much is it going to take? What is the will and capability of these various partners? Of course, the other element that I think is important is while we do have a new Iraqi government, we have to see how willing they are to leave behind the sectarian ways and really embrace the Sunnis and mend their fences with the Kurds. That is a critical political part of the strategy. And frankly, the new government is formed, but it doesn't have a defense minister. It doesn't have a security minister. And when I saw the initial proposed occupant of the Interior Ministry, Hadi al-Amiri, the head of the Badr Corps, a major Shia militia, that is not a name that is going to attract Sunni support to this government. Now, he was ultimately turned aside as the pick, but it is critical that this government be formed in a very ecumenical way.
Well, quickly, reading between the lines, it sounds like you're saying we are late to the game in the U.S., and the Iraqi forces probably aren't ready.
Yes, we really have to find the capable Iraqi units and build them up. We have to have the right signals from the Iraqi government that they understand this is an existential threat, and they must reach out to all Iraqis if they're going to tackle it. And I think we have a real problem with the Syrian opposition because they're so weak. They've been nearly decimated. They've lost most of their territory. They're hanging on by a thread in Aleppo. So we really have a big job ahead to fulfill what the president has laid out.
Linda Robinson is senior international policy analyst at the RAND Corporation and author of 100 Victories, Special Ops, and the Future of American Warfare. Thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
Did you hear the president last night? President Obama says this is still our fight, this war on terror in Iraq and Syria. The president authorized the sending of more than 400 military personnel back to the region. Equipment will be going there as well. Does the threat of ISIS warrant a new round of fighting 13 years after the attacks on 9/11? What are you feeling? Some of our listeners support the president and the steps he outlined last night.
My name is James from San Antonio, Texas. I'm a veteran myself, but I understand from all the combat zones that I've been to that the only time we ever actually use military force is when all their options have ever been exhausted. If the president and the government say that we should and we need to go back to Iraq, we should and we need to go back to Iraq. That's what being in the military is about. We make the sacrifices that most people don't think about.
Well, what about the rest of you? Most of you, at least who called us at 877-8-MY-TAKE, do not support the president.
This is Chris. I'm calling you from Delray Beach, Florida. I feel that there's no need for any invasion and any military force from any country. I think they should bring all the troops home so we can protect ourselves here.
Is the war on terror an open-ended conflict that will go on many, many years after 9/11? It's already gone on for 13 years. The president has reauthorized some sort of military intervention to deal with ISIS, the Islamic State in the Middle East. What do you think? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Be a part of the conversation. You can also find us at facebook.com/thetakeback. We want to give you an update on the Ebola crisis in West Africa. The World Health Organization says the number of cases will rise in the coming days, spiking from just under 2,000 to possibly many thousand. In Liberia this week, the country's defense minister said the epidemic threatens Liberia's national existence. Dr. Timothy Flanagan is part of a desperate race to bolster the healthcare infrastructure in Liberia to deal with this crisis. He's a professor of medicine and infectious diseases at the Alpert Medical School at Brown University. Welcome, doctor.
Thanks so much. I'm glad to be talking with you all.
Dr. Flanagan, what does it mean that the country's defense minister says that this epidemic might threaten Liberia's national existence?
Well, we know that the current Ebola epidemic in West Africa and Liberia is particularly hard hit, truly is devastating. But Ebola as a virus particularly spreads when people are very sick. This means the impact is heaviest in family members and in the health system, the health sector. So currently, the general clinics and many of the general hospitals are shut down. So if you have malaria or typhoid, you can be in deep trouble. On the other hand, I can tell you, just 2 days ago, I was at the Star of the Sea Clinic, which is in West Point, where, as you know, there was a lot of unrest and a quarantine for a brief period of time. The staff there were so extraordinary. They do have protective equipment, and they have been providing care every day. And I saw two babies that were just newborn that very morning when I was there, which was so special. So there, many of the Liberian healthcare workers have been heroic. But in general, the healthcare system and the health sector is suffering very, very terribly.
Is there a fundamental difference in the way Ebola is manifesting itself in Nigeria, Liberia, and Sierra Leone? You've described the situation in Liberia. Are the governments handling it differently in these places?
You know, there's been a tremendous amount of support from WHO and the Centers for Disease Control, our government there, and the governments in all these countries are working closely together. The U.S. government has done a tremendous amount helping through both USAID, also through the Centers for Disease Control, also through laboratory support. Just this last weekend, President Obama said that the U.S. military medical arm would kick in and really engage and really help. And that is such wonderful news. The U.S. military medical arm has spent an enormous amount of money and effort to be very well prepared for epidemics such as this. They know how to operate. They know how to care for patients safely within this setting. They can do it better than anyone else in the world.
Do you agree that the number of cases is likely to spike in the next couple of weeks in Sierra Leone and Liberia and become many thousands as opposed to where it's hovered around just under 2,000 at this point?
Yes, but the reason for that is as awareness increases, people will go to the Ebola treatment units earlier, which is a good thing. When they do that, they will get tested much earlier. There'll be more people getting tested. That is a good thing. As you have more testing, you will detect more cases. So previously, many people were ill, probably with Ebola, and they hid. But now with much better awareness and a much better community response, there will be more numbers over the next few weeks. And we hope then that we will begin to see it lowering after that.
Are you afraid another American with Ebola has been evacuated to Atlanta for a treatment in the United States?
Of course, like anybody else, I'm fearful of getting sick and fearful of getting sick from Ebola. But we have information and protection. But I have such deep admiration for these healthcare workers. They are fearful and their families are fearful. But they know that if they don't go to work, that pregnant woman won't get the care that she needs. And they say, I'm a nurse. I'm a physician's assistant. I'm a doctor. I will be there.
Dr. Timothy Flanagan is professor of medicine and infectious diseases at the Albert Medical School at Brown University, speaking to us from Monrovia, Liberia. Dr. Flanagan, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
And now the story of a factory running at full tilt for a half a century.
Twice a day, on his way to and from school, little Charlie Bucket had to walk right past the gates of the factory. And every time he went by, he would begin to walk very, very slowly. And he would hold his nose high in the air and take long, deep sniffs of the gorgeous, chocolatey smell all around him. Oh, how he loved that smell!
This factory did not create many jobs, but it did create millions of readers. When Roald Dahl's Charlie and the Chocolate Factory was first published in the U.S. 50 years ago this month, it was a bestseller right off the bat. How could you go wrong with a factory of yummy chocolate? Characters zany and strange with names like Veruca Salt, Augustus Gloop, Willy Wonka, Beauregard. You may not have heard of the characters Miranda Grope or Elvira Erstwhile, Clarence Crump and Bertie Upside. They were in early drafts of the book when writer Roald Dahl was just starting out to become the legendary children's author we know of him as today. Writer Lucy Mangan brings those early days to life in her new book, Inside Charlie's Chocolate Factory, commissioned for the book's 50th anniversary.
It was Roald Dahl's second book for children. He was a well-established writer for adults, adult short stories, published in The New Yorker and all sorts of kind of Tony publications. And then he turned to writing for children once he had children and got very bored reading the usual children's books to them. And Charlie and the Chocolate Factory grew out of a bedtime story he was telling his two oldest. And he started to write it down, and then he sent a draft in to his publishers, and they loved it, said it needed some work, and he went away and worked on it. And we've got five still surviving drafts of the story before you get to the final published book that we all know.
And when you look at the drafts, what is it he's tweaking as he moves towards the final product?
Well, it's quite interesting, really, because he starts off actually with quite a formulaic story. It's called Charlie and the Chocolate Boy, the very first draft we've got. There's another draft we think he threw away because he read it out to his nephew, and his nephew told him it was rubbish. So we think he threw that away. But the first surviving draft is this story called Charlie's Chocolate Boy, where there are 10 children, and 10 are chosen every week. It's just a regular thing. 10 get to go to the factory every week. And during this story, Charlie accidentally gets into a chocolate boy mold and gets made into a chocolate boy, supposedly hollow chocolate boy, gets delivered to Wonka's house because he has a wife and a son at this point, and is taken there as a present for the son, Freddy. And while he's there, perched on the mantelpiece inside this chocolate shell, foils a burglar in, is rewarded by Wonka with a sweet shop all of his own. So that's a very quite normal little adventure story. And then over the course of these drafts, you see him just, I gradually get rid of this boring stock stuff. And why don't we just go bigger, better, brighter, gum machine, square sweets that look round. And he's off and away.
The sense of characters that Roald Dahl has, and particularly in this story, you know, he's like Dickens. It's like he's got so many fantastic names. And if one doesn't work, he just tosses it away. And it moves on. What are the evolution of some of the characters here as we go across these drafts?
Well, they're all very lively and sort of full of colour and, as you say, Dickensian from the beginning. But because he's new to the craft of children's writing especially, he starts off with too many. As I say, he had the 10, and he has some great names. He has Violet Strabismus, which is the medical term for a squint, and he has Herpes Trout, which obviously has to go at some point.
Yeah, yeah.
And that kind of thing. But they're all very funny, very vivid, and really it comes down to just being a sort of unwieldy number. So he has to kind of do the Faulkner thing and kill all your darlings. He gradually whittles them down to the five that we know today.
And I learned that Elvira Entwistle might have replaced perhaps one of the most famous characters from the eventual story.
Yeah, she was the original name for Veruca Salt. Violet was also Violet Glockenberry at one point, which also works really well.
Well, it's Huckleberry. I would have gone with Glockenberry. I like that.
Would you?
Yeah.
Yeah, I like that.
So what changed about the characters in particular, and is there an example of a character evolution that shows, you know, where he was headed in his mind as to where this story was all about?
Well, it's interesting because actually, even in the very first draft, the main characters are there and actually don't change much. It's more a matter of winnowing out the other ones, the slightly weaker ones, or the ones that overlap too much. I mean, he has a girl called Miranda Grope, renamed Miranda Mary Piker in the second draft, who is also sucked up the pipe, like Augustus Pottle, then Gloop is. And she ends up in the peanut brittle room. But she's just a different kind of spoilt. She's the child of kind of very liberal, progressive parents, which obviously Dahl is a kind of upper-class Englishman, you know, quite hated at the beginning of the 60s. And they won't punish her. They believe in freedom of expression and all the rest. But I think he thought that was too subtle a joke for a children's book. So Augustus gets to stay. You know, the gluttonous vice gets to stay. And this more, you know, in many ways funnier, but not for children, character has to go. So there's a lot of that going. You can see him weighing things in the balance.
Are there any characters that you wished had made it into the final draft?
Well, I do love Miranda Mary Piker with her awful parents. And when she, because I love that there's this great scene where she's running around the chocolate meadow, the meadow around the chocolate river, and she grabs a handful of daffodils and someone says, "Oh, are you going to give those to your mother?" And she says, "No, I'm going to gobble them up all myself." And her mother says, you see how interesting a child she is. And you know those people. They're awful people. They should all be taken to a peanut brittle room and brittle to death.
I wonder if this manuscript would have the same fate today. I can't even believe that 50 years have gone by.
I know, I couldn't believe. When they said, you know, would you like to write this book to celebrate 50 years? I was like, it can't be. It is timeless. And I think that's because it's a modern fairy tale, and fairy tales are timeless. They don't date. They've got emblematic virtues and vices. And as long as humanity is walking around making the same horrible mistakes and doing the same wonderful things, we'll always respond to fairy tales. But it is amazing that the chocolate factory still has that lure, and we all want to go back and dive in again.
Lucy Mangan is the author of Inside Charlie's Chocolate Factory. Her book looks at the children's classic at 50 years young.
Honey, I'm home.
Hi, darling. Gee, it's good to have you home.
Oh, it's good to be home.
Did you have a nice day?
Just great. How was your day?
Just fine.
Married people in black and white there. TV couples like Dick Van Dyke and Mary Tyler Moore. As American as apple pie, right? Well, not anymore. And remember, in the 70s, Mary did her own show where she was single, the Mary Tyler Moore Show. More recently, everyone laughed at the movie Bridesmaids. But why? Because they love the idea of being married or hate it? Can you tell?
You know what? If I ever had a wedding, I'd want everybody to be stress-free, you know? I'd like it to be like a carnival.
Mm-hmm. You could have elephants, and the bride and groom can walk on a little tightrope.
Okay, what you're talking about there, that's a circus wedding.
Oh.
It's a totally different...
This is Michelle calling in from Austin, Texas. My fiancé and I started our family together almost 2 years before we got engaged. We're in no hurry to get married. I'm not sure that we could have done things in this order 20 years ago, but I have several friends who started their families before they were married, and it just doesn't seem that odd anymore.
Thank you, listener Michelle. Singles rule, folks. For the first time on record since the Bureau of Labor Statistics started keeping track back in the 70s when Mary Tyler Moore was a hit, more than half of all Americans are single. We asked you to report on the sociological changes outside your windows.
This is Gil from St. Louis. That is not the case in my family or in a suburban community. However, stories from and about young people at work or at church tell stories of relationship breakups or divorce. The American tradition of marriage is and has been in big trouble.
Well, Eric Kleinenberg knows all about this. The happily married sociology professor at New York University is also the author of Going Solo, The Extraordinary Rise and Surprising Appeal of Living Alone. Welcome, Professor.
Nice to be here.
So I gather we've kind of stepped into a archaic institution called marriage. We're just not cool anymore.
What were we thinking?
Yeah.
There's so many new ways to live these days.
Right. Is singleness an example of something that relates to the difficulty of linking up in this society the way it's going? Or is there really a preference to not being married?
Well, I think there are a few things going on. I mean, actually, it's probably easier to meet people than ever before if you think about all the incredible technologies we have to connect and find people for dating. You'd think we'd have solved that problem. One big issue is people today really are looking for their soulmate, and they're not going to compromise. They're not going to settle down. But another big thing is it's just become legitimate and viable to be single for a long period of time. That was never the case before.
And looking for your soulmate forever could maybe be more interesting romantically than getting hitched up for life. Is that kind of what's going on here, the eHarmony.coms and everything else that makes it possible to find multiple soulmates over the course of a lifetime?
Well, I do think there's a little bit of that paradox of choice problem where you have so many different options, it's easy to find the flaws with each one and difficult to just pick some person with all their flaws, since we all do have them, and then just stay with it. But I think another thing is people are spending a big chunk of their lives, you know, much of their 20s and even into their 30s increasingly, becoming a grown-up. They're investing their time in their job. They feel anxious about their career, and they're having a very difficult time kind of moving into that next stage of what we've traditionally thought of as grown-up life.
Well, the other way of looking at this is they've spent so much time alone that, you know, they've got their stuff and their space, and they're not really terribly good at sharing it.
Well, one thing I learned about living alone from doing all these interviews is that people who live alone have a degree of control over their time and space that very few other people have. They have a chance for a solitude and a kind of a productive solitude. You know, we live in this moment of incredible hyper-connection. We are always engaged with social life through social media. When you live alone, you have a little oasis in your apartment. And I think paradoxically, a lot of people who live alone, whether they're young adults or people who've just gotten out of a marriage that ended in divorce or separation, living alone gives you a chance to kind of get back on your feet and figure out who you are and what you want in your next relationship so you can make kind of a stronger return to social life.
Now, others would say you get to go back to being narcissistic and ignoring the fact that you need to share.
You know, I thought something like that when I started the work for Going Solo. I mean, I really thought this was going to be a story about the selfish singletons and the narcissists out there, but I was totally wrong about that.
Wow.
It turns out that people who live alone are actually more likely to volunteer in civic organizations than people who are married. They're also more likely to spend time with friends and with neighbors. And of course, they're a big reason that there's so much activity and vitality in the public areas of cities today. They're not people who are self-involved, you know, sitting on the couch just buying things for themselves on eBay. They're really a crucial part of modern social life.
So, you know, the Bureau of Labor Statistics was the one keeping these stats. And I'm wondering if this is just an economic story. If kids are expensive, being married is kind of expensive, or at least it involves mortgages and all these kinds of, you know, huge expenses, cars, that sort of thing. Living alone is just more efficient.
Well, the truth is that living alone has been on the rise for decades now. It predates the recession. Really, up until about the 1950s, you can't find a single society in the history of our species that sustained large numbers of people living alone for long periods of time. But when we hit this prosperity of the post-World War II moment, we see it take off like never before. In my book, I call it the biggest social change of the last 60 years that we've really failed to name or identify. It was 22% of American adults were single in 1950, and the census records this as well.
Wow.
And today we know now that it's more than half. This is an enormous social change, and we're just beginning to grapple with it.
Does your wife get a little nervous about you writing a book called Going Solo, The Extraordinary Rise and Surprising Appeal of Living Alone? I mean, hello?
You know, she calls that my fantasy book. But, you know, the truth is that when you really get down to it, there's a grass is greener problem that just about everyone has. So there's no perfect way to live.
All right. But that's fine. But I'm going for the jugular here.
I avoided the question.
Yeah. Yeah. You come home and say, honey, I'm going to write a book called Going Solo, The Appeal of Living Alone. And your wife either says, great, that's a brilliant idea. It'll put our kids through college. Or she says, get lost.
Yeah, well, fortunately, she's a cultural anthropologist and is interested in exploring new kinds of things as well. So she has been amazingly generous.
Very supportive. She understands you, Eric.
Everyone has some people out there who can, and the trick is finding them.
You're a lucky man.
I couldn't agree more.
Thanks so much for talking to us. Eric Kleinenberg, sociology professor at New York University, author of Going Solo, The Extraordinary Rise and Surprising Appeal of Living Alone. Thanks.
Hey, it's been a pleasure.
So are you still waiting, or how is that single life working out for you? From Fenton, Missouri, one of you says, as a time-worn millennial, I feel I can speak for our entire generation by saying marriage is expensive and dumb. Why bother? Is that a woman or a man speaking?
Hi, my name is Marisa. I'm calling from Astoria, New York. I'm 26 years old. Most of my friends are older than me, and only one of them is married. I think it's because women have become so independent and no longer rely on men for support financially. We're able to live the lives that we would like to live as individuals, and finding a partner is secondary to our own life goals and happiness.
Well, thank you for sharing, Marisa. Being single, is it better for men or women? What do you think? How about marriage? Better deal for men? Better deal for women? Tell us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. And if you want to catch up on that conversation or listen back to anything on the program, you can check us out at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry, married for 19 years. My anniversary is coming up. What am I going to do? Oh boy. This is The Takeaway.
PRI, Public Radio International.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here? And maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.